People in Bahrain staged nationwide rallies on the eve of the 10th anniversary of an uprising against the Al-Khalifa regime. UN Food Agency says a record 12.4 million people in Syria are struggling to find enough food to eat, describing the situation as alarming. And U.S. Senate votes to acquit former President Donald Trump in his impeachment trial. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, Bahrainis have staged nationwide demonstrations on the eve of the 10th anniversary of a popular uprising against the Al-Khalifa regime. Protests were held in several towns and villages near the capital, Manama. People called for an end to human rights violations and the release of political prisoners. They also urged the Al-Khalifa regime to relinquish power and allow for the establishment of a just system. Meanwhile, Bahrain's top cleric, Sheikh Isa Qasim, says the opposition movement in the country will not let up until final victory is gained in the face of the regime's crackdown.
With time, we can see that people have continued their uprising, and they continue to achieve their aspirations and their demands, and they have great aspiration in order to reach their demands, no matter how long it would take, no matter how harsh the oppression is, and no matter what the circumstances.
Sheikh Isa Qasim made the comments in a live address from the Iranian city of Qom. He said uprising seeks to rectify the wrongdoings of the Al-Khalifa regime. The top cleric said the Bahraini people want to take control of their own country and resources. Bahrainis have been staging demonstrations on a regular basis since a popular uprising kicked off back in early 2011. However, the regime has brutally suppressed the protests and has arrested, injured, and killed thousands of people in the tiny island nation. Political analyst Zafar Bangesh joined us earlier, saying the Western countries should support Bahraini protesters' demand and stop backing the Al-Khalifa.
Well, first of all, as I mentioned, that there are Saudi forces also operating there. And prior to this year, the Saudis, of course, were also looked upon with great favor by the West. But the most crucial point, of course, is that Bahrain happens to be the base of the U.S. Fifth Fleet. And the United States, of course, wishes to keep that Fifth Fleet over there, because as a result of the Fifth Fleet, it is able to destabilize the region and terrorize people in the region. And so it serves America's interest to keep this regime in power so that America's Fifth Fleet can continue to operate from there. And I think it is time that the rest of the world took note of it and stood shoulder to shoulder with the people of Bahrain to give them their legitimate rights as well.
The United Nations Food Agency says a record 12.4 million people in Syria are struggling to find enough food to eat. The World Food Program says the figure means 60% of the population in the war-torn country is now food insecure. WFP spokeswoman Jessica Lawson said it's alarming that a basic meal is now beyond the reach of a majority of Syrian families. A decade of war and militancy has ravaged the Syrian economy and sent inflation rates soaring throughout the country. The Syria conflict has killed more than 387,000 people and displaced millions more since it began back in 2011. Political commentator Judith Bellows says alarming food insecurity in Syria is caused by Washington sanctions on the Arab country.
This is caused by the sanctions the United States has placed on Syria, which are essentially a part of their war on Syria. This is a siege war. This is a way to make sure that the people don't eat. It's a medieval tactic of war that they're using on the Syrian people, and they say that they're targeting government officials or whomever, but in fact, their goal is to starve the people into submission. And there is absolutely no excuse for this. Right now, it's nearly impossible to get aid into Syria. They had a whole flap at the United Nations 6 months ago or so, where they were voting on how many entry points the United Nations could have into Syria, but all of the entry points were into northern Syria, into either Idlib or into areas controlled by the Kurds in northern Syria.
Yeah, many doctors say they cannot cope with the rising number of child malnutrition cases in the country.
Right now, cases of malnutrition are on the rise, more so than in previous years. Cases admitted daily have increased to between 4 and 5. There are several reasons for the increase in malnutrition, like the withdrawal of aid organizations. The health situation cannot cope. There are severe shortages in supplies, in the treatments needed, in examinations, and everything else. We ask the United Nations and other aid organizations to help lift the blockade as soon as possible.
On Thursday, 4 UN agencies warned that at least 400,000 Yemeni children under the age of five, could starve to death this year. And the World Body also projected the number of children under five suffering from severe acute malnutrition will rise by 22% this year compared to last year. And this comes amid Saudi Arabia's ongoing war on the impoverished nation and the coronavirus pandemic. Riyadh's military action has pushed Yemen into what the UN has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Tens of thousands of Yemenis have died since Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war on its southern neighbor back in early 2015. The European Union has called for a halt to arms exports to the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates over the war on Yemen. During our news review program, we've discussed this issue in length with our guests. Here it is.
And now it's time for news review. The European Parliament has called on member states to ban arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the UAE over human rights violations in Yemen. EU lawmakers also passed a resolution on Thursday urging all parties to facilitate the rapid and unimpeded passage of humanitarian relief to the Yemeni population. The move came after the United States announced plans to halt arms sales to Saudi Arabia and suspend the transfer of F-35 jets to the UAE. Washington also said it would revoke its designation of Yemen's Ansarullah movement as a terrorist organization. I'd like to welcome my guest to this news review, Elijah Macnia, a journalist and political analyst out of Brussels, and Jason Unruhi, political commentator out of Niagara Falls, Ontario. Thank you both for being with us. Well, Elijah, let's start it off with you. What's your take on the suggestion now by the European Parliament?
Hello, thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming.
I'm today with a member of the Parliament who voted, and he said, and I quote, "It is very unusual for the EU Parliament to agree with such unity to end a terrible war that was supported 100% for so long by the US in many EU countries." So the vote of 638 members out of 705 imposing arms export on Saudi Arabia and the Emirates came as a surprise, because suddenly the conscience of all the parliament is waking up after 6 years of war, and it coincides with the advance of the Ansarullah on Ma'rib to take it back and to liberate it from the Saudi supported troop in the city. And even if we hear that Joseph Borrell said the situation in Yemen deserved more attention, I mean, where were he and the parliament 6 years ago? All throughout the 6 years, mm-hmm. when 8% of the Yemeni population are in need of humanitarian assistance, we heard members of the parliament saying 10 children are dying every minute in Yemen. So suddenly there is this realization after 6 years. That is pure hypocrisy.
Jason, your take, you heard what Elijah said. Do you think that actually the reason that the European Parliament has voted the way that it has is because of what Elijah had pointed out, and more and more losses by the Saudi regime, despite they should have an advantage as far as weapons and as far as aircrafts, and they're continually bombing that impoverished land. But they can't seem to win the war overall. So is that the real reason that we're seeing this so-called change of heart by some of these Western countries?
I think that's very much the case. I think that the imperialist powers of the world, the old Europeans and the new Western ones, are essentially telling Saudi Arabia to give it up. I think that this is their way of telling them, you've tried, you failed, you're not going to win, just let it go before this situation becomes any more embarrassing. Not just embarrassing that they were unable to defeat a force that was in such a disadvantaged position, but that the ongoing, what is essentially a genocide in the country, is making many of these so-called champions of freedom and democracy look like the terrible individuals that they are, despite the claims by many of the old European colonial powers and the current U.S. imperialist power to be the ones that want to civilize and bring peace to the world, and the United States now saying that it's going to return as the world leader under the administration of Biden. I think they're very much showing that this is a failed endeavor. Let it go and withdraw Saudi troops from there, and they'll begin another plan in order to destabilize the country and make it, manipulate it into their favor, which is what this was all about to begin with. So I think that this is essentially the final nail in the coffin for the Saudi effort, who is acting as a proxy force for many of these foreign powers. And to give the final word to the Saudis, to give it up. You talked a very big game. You demonstrated a significant military power, but it was not enough in the end to defeat the Houthi forces in the country. And this is just embarrassing now.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me here on the News Review. Elijah Macnea, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. Jason Unruhy, political commentator out of Niagara Falls, Ontario.
A new report says the Israeli regime has demolished at least 178 buildings in the West Bank since the beginning of the year, leaving hundreds of Palestinian families homeless, including women and children, obviously. Mona Candil reports.
Since the beginning of 2021 alone, Israeli forces have destroyed at least 178 Palestinian buildings in the occupied West Bank, rendering at least 259 Palestinians homeless, including 140 children. According to a report by the Office for the Coordinator of Humanitarian Affairs in the Palestinian Territories, OCHA, the recent demolitions took place in mainly the Bedouin community of Humsa village in the northern Jordan Valley.
Israel is seeking to expel Palestinians from their villages and towns to first seize their lands and then build further settlements. It doesn't respect the UN resolutions, whether those of the General Assembly or the Security Council.
Israeli authorities continue with the demolition of Palestinian buildings in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and Area C, which makes up 60% of the West Bank. The Area C is under Israel's full military, security, and administrative control. Lack of Israeli-issued building permit is typically cited as the reason for demolition, even though, due to the restrictive and discriminatory planning regime, Palestinians can almost never obtain such permits. Experts say demolitions serve as a key means of creating an environment that leaves Palestinians with no other choice than to be forced to leave their homes and towns.
What is going on is part of the annexation plan. Israel is after forcing Palestinians to leave their homes. Tens of thousands of Palestinians live on their private lands in these areas, and their presence prevents Israel from carrying out its annexation plan.
In 2020, Israeli soldiers demolished near 900 buildings belonging to Palestinians and displaced more than 1,000 people in the occupied West Bank. Israeli regime's demolition of Palestinian structures and the occupied territories is illegal, according to the international community. It's also seen as part of Tel Aviv's aggressive policies against the Palestinians. Palestinians living under rigid military rule and without political rights described the destruction of their homes as a policy of ethnic cleansing. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Taliban warned NATO against seeking a continuation of war in Afghanistan, calling on the Western alliance to fully withdraw its troops from the country. Now, in a statement, the militant group said anyone seeking an extension of war and occupation will be held liable. Taliban said conflict is neither in the interest of NATO or the Afghan people. NATO defense ministers will meet next week to discuss whether the alliance's mission should stay or go. Former U.S. President Donald Trump struck a deal with the militant group last year, which requires foreign troops leave Afghanistan by May 2021. President Joe Biden's administration, however, said that it will review the deal, accusing the militants of not meeting their commitment to reduce violence. The U.S. Senate has voted to acquit a former U.S. President Donald Trump, concluding now his second impeachment trial.
The Senate, having tried Donald John Trump, former President of the United States, upon one article of impeachment exhibited against him by the House of Representatives, and two-thirds of the senators present, not having found him guilty of the charge contained therein, it is therefore ordered and adjudged that the said Donald John Trump be, and he is hereby, acquitted of the charge in said article.
Congress upper chamber voted 57-43 to exonerate Trump, who was accused of inciting an insurrection on the Capitol building last month. In a statement, Donald Trump called the trial the greatest witch hunt in the history of the U.S. Democratic Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer slammed the verdict as un-American, saying that 43 senators who voted not guilty will be forever linked to Trump's terrible legacy. And Democrats had warned that acquitting the former president will open the door for future presidents to violate their office in the final weeks of their presidency without suffering any accountability. Now, Brazil reports more than 1,000 new COVID-19-related deaths as the Americas struggle to contain the coronavirus pandemic. Now, Brazil still has the world's second-largest coronavirus death toll with nearly 240,000 fatalities. South American nation also reported 44,000 new cases over the last day, raising its total to nearly 9.8 million. Meanwhile, COVID-19 infections and deaths continue to surge in America despite the country's vaccination rollout programs. According to Johns Hopkins University, the virus has infected over 27.5 million people and claimed more than 483,000 lives in the world's worst hit country. U.S. health officials say out of nearly 70 million vaccines distributed, some 50 million have so far been administered. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Samer Arbit's case is just the latest example of Israeli regime forces going unpunished for vicious human rights abuses, says Tal Steiner, the executive director of the Public Committee Against Torture, in an article published under the heading, Torture of Palestinian Prisoners, Time to End Israeli Regime's Impunity. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. On September 25, 2019, a Palestinian man was arrested by Israeli regime troops and transferred to the compound detention facility in Al-Quds for interrogation by Israeli regime's internal intelligence agency, the Shin Bet. Samer Arbid's arrest marked the beginning of a wave of arrests in the ensuing months throughout the occupied West Bank. Later, media publications would describe this operation as a crackdown on the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. For 2 days after his arrest, Arbid, who had been otherwise healthy at the time of his arrest, was brought to Al-Quds Harasa Hospital in critical condition, suffering from kidney failure and broken ribs. He was placed on a respirator until his condition stabilized, and then, to the shame of the military court that approved it, sent back to the custody of the Shin Bet. What happened to Arbid between his arrest and his arrival at a hospital is an open secret. All signs indicate that he was tortured by Shin Bet agents. He and other suspects were reportedly forced into stress positions used routinely by Shin Bet agents, as documented in hundreds of testimonies gathered by the Public Committee Against Torture in the Occupied Palestine. One such position is the banana, in which the subject of interrogation is bent over a chair, hands and legs chained together underneath. Even a few minutes in this position can cause severe pain and suffering, without leaving visible marks. But forensic medicine shows that kidney failure can be associated with the use of stress positions, where the strained muscles release acid into the bloodstream that the body cannot handle. The expectation was that when a person was brought to near death while in the hands of the Shin Bet, the Israeli regime system would jolt into action, investigate and press charges. Otherwise, how could the Zionist regime maintain that torture was prohibited in the territory and that perpetrators would be held accountable? Indeed, the Israeli regime's attorney general ordered an investigation into the matter, but it concluded on January 24th with a decision to close the case, in the absence of sufficient evidence to prove an offense. On the one hand, why should we be surprised by this, when according to data collected by the Public Committee Against Torture, of more than 1,300 complaints by interrogation subjects against Shin Bet agents, no charges were laid for torture or abuse. Only one even resulted in a criminal investigation, while the rest were dismissed after a preliminary examination. On the other hand, one cannot underestimate the gravity of this decision, where a person almost lost his life while in the custody of the Zionist regime authorities, but the people who brought him there received full impunity. Internally, the Attorney General's decision sends a message to all Israeli regime security agents that the system will back them, no matter how outrageous, brutal, and dangerous their actions. Indeed, Shin Bet head Nadav Agerman later gave his full support to the interrogators, saying they carried out their mission professionally, in a statesmanlike manner, and according to law, and in their action saved the lives of many Israelis, he said. Internationally, the decision proves beyond a doubt that the Zionist regime lacks the ability or rather the motivation to meet its obligations under the United Nations Convention Against Torture, which aims to abolish torture and condemn those who commit it. It is time for both the Israeli regime and the international community to speak up against the Zionist regime's continued use of torture against Palestinians and others, along with the impunity given to perpetrators of this heinous crime. Torture is wrong and illegal under any circumstances.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone, and congratulations on the auspicious birthday anniversary of Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace be upon him. Today is a blessed day of the start of the sacred month of Rajab. And let us hear what the fifth infallible successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, has said regarding the keys of faith. O Jabir, the first beings that God created were Muhammad and his family, the rightly guided ones and the guides. These were shadows of light, luminous bodies without spirits. They were strengthened by the Holy Spirit, or Ruhul Qudus, through which Muhammad and his family worshipped God. For that reason, he created them forbearing, learned, endowed with filial piety and pure. They worship God through prayer, through fasting, prostrating themselves, enumerating his names, and pronouncing Allahu Akbar, or God is great.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shoma dar in qarn mojza kardid, millat Iran, millat mojza asay qarn ast.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners to our program, The Man Who Changed the World. This is a program that is about the life and times of Imam Khomeini. May God bless his soul. And once again, I'm your host for this program, Ijaz Hussain, and I also have my good friend, Dr. Mahdi Turabi, on the line. And I'd just like to say salam and welcome him to the program.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you, Dr. Mahdi Turabi. We are speaking about the man who changed the world, and we got to the stage where we discussed some personality and characteristics of the Imam, of course, in the last sessions we had. But today we're going to talk about how Imam Khomeini has revived religion put religion on the map in terms of the fact both as far as Islam is concerned and as far as spirituality is concerned around the globe. Dr. Mahdi Turabi, your take on that?
Well, I think one of the important features or one of the important effects or consequences of having a personality like Imam enter the scene was exactly that, what you mentioned, which is that it really was all about reviving Islam. And because at that time we lived in a world where, you know, the Western civilization was dominant.
Yes.
And in that civilization, you know, religion was really becoming a secondary issue.
Yes, it was.
Or was becoming something that was marginal or that was, you know, related to a minority of the population.
Sure.
And then if you look at all the intellectual climate of that time in that dominant civilization, it was, you know, pretty much across the board secular, whether it was left-wing secular, you know, Marxist, or liberal secular, or even on the right, you know, if you look at, you know, movements such as neoconservatism or the kind of secular right wing, if you look at the States or if you look at Thatcher in Britain.
Yeah, yeah. Reminded me of the Iron Lady again, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, Jesus.
There really wasn't any more space for any kind of religious discourse.
Sure.
Or the religious discourse that was marginalized.
It was very much marginalized. You're absolutely right.
Or it was, you know, labeled as just, you know, fundamentalist and whatever. And of course, this also relates to Christianity and the inability of Christianity at that time, and still, I would argue today, to really
To cope with the issues of today. That's absolutely right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so here we had, and in Islam, we had a similar situation in the sense that when you had the those branches of Islam that didn't follow the school of Ahlul Bayt, they were also confronted with this inability to really offer solutions to, you know, the believers or the people.
Sure.
Maybe
sure.
maybe less so than Christianity, but still there was a lot of problems.
Sure.
That
I mean, to be honest, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, the thing is that, you know, hindsight's a great thing, you know, and when we look back on the situation, I mean, when we see what the hell is going on in the Middle East with the Takfiris and all the rest of it, we can certainly understand that, you know, why they were not able to cope with anything, because they're pretty much in the pocket of the West, at the, you know, even today. So,
well, of course. I mean, that's one aspect of it when you're talking about Takfiris and Al Saud and that kind of branch of things.
Our favorite topic.
Also, I'm also talking about, you know, so-called mainstream or, you know, moderate Sunnism.
Absolutely.
Which, because of certain...
deficiencies.
Yeah, deficiencies as it relates to, and I'll be very specific, for example, that they don't accept logic or logical reasoning in
that's
their
right.
theology
well,
any longer.
To be honest, you know, Mantik
was... And this is a problem, you know, when you want to deal with... When you want to deal with life, when you want to deal with living, you know, in the world on a daily basis and trying to help people, because, you know, what's the point of having a religion if it's just based on, you know, I'm just going to have personal prayer, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, who needs a religion like that? You know?
Exactly.
And we talked about this, as you may have
thought. I mean, this is the thing that, you know, as you say, that even Mantik was completely dropped by many Sunni madrasas. They don't even study it now. They don't even look at it.
Again, I mean, you know, we have to look at why would we, you know, this is a completely secularized and westernized, modernized version of religion, what is a lot of people have in their head, which is that it's just this personal thing. Well, of course, religion is not just a personal thing.
Absolutely.
You know, and this is the problem that we have is, you know, why do we even, you know, what's the point of having a religion if it's just a personal thing, you know?
Yeah.
You have, a religion has to be involved socially, has to care about justice, has to care about fighting evil, and has to care about, you know, offering solutions to daily problems. It has to help people.
Sure.
It's not just there to, you know, make them feel good.
Sure.
Okay? Which is what Christianity had become, or has become in many instances.
Sure, sure. Absolutely.
And so we had these fundamental, structural, historical problems with religion that, you know, was... And as a result, the religion was completely leaving the lives of people. It was no longer a factor in the lives of many people.
Sure.
And so, because, as we claim, you know, we have that very pure and real school of Ahlul Bayt, which is the closest that we have to the real deen, the real deen al-haq. Because remember, from an Islamic perspective, we don't have different religions. We have one religion.
Absolutely.
It's the latest version. Yes. And the final version.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the final version of it.
It's the final version of it, yes.
Right?
Yes.
So it's not like we can say, well, you know, we have Christianity and Islam and Judaism. Yes, we do, and on a certain level when we're talking about, you know, legally speaking.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
In terms of, you know, the followers of the Ahlul Kitab having rights and you know...
From a completely...
being respected legally.
Yeah, fifth point of view, yes, that's right.
Right,
yes.
But in terms of the reality of it, in terms of what it is that God has revealed to His creation, and the Risala that is being, you know... given as guidance to humanity, well, we only have one religion, which is Deen al-Haq, as it says in the Quran, which is, you know, the religion that was revealed to the Prophet, peace be upon him.
Exactly, and that's perfect, that's complete.
And it happens to be called Islam.
Yes.
And in that religion, you have the unfortunate events that occurred after the demise of the Prophet, peace be upon him, that... you know, which is why a certain group within Islam say that they follow the school of Ahlul Bayt.
Yes.
The family of the Prophet.
Sure.
And so it is that school out of which Imam Khomeini comes out of.
Exactly.
And it is that pure and what he called the Muhammadi Islam.
The Muhammadi Islam, that's right. He used to say the pure Muhammadan Islam, yes.
Pure Muhammadan Islam, as opposed to, remember what he used to call it?
American Islam.
American Islam.
Yeah. Salami Amiriki.
Yeah. Which is that Islam, which is, oh, you know, don't get involved in social matters,
exactly.
Don't get involved in political matters.
Yes.
It's just a personal thing, you know. You know,
just have a KFC next to the Kaaba, eh?
Well, and again, I mean, you know, it's funny you mentioned that because I think that's so symbolic and that's such a clear example of, you know, what's the... They always talk about, you know... Mm. You know, isn't that the biggest perversion itself? That you would even if it's halal, because they talk about, well,
it's halal.
You know, it's halal. You know, we have halal KFC. Or we
halal
have halal
KFC
McDonald's,
next to the car.
Or halal McDonald's, or halal whatever.
My God.
And, you know, isn't that just, you know, doesn't that say everything about how they don't understand anything?
Prophet Ibrahim, peace be upon him, missed out on that one.
Right, I mean, you know, forget about Zamzam.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
he should have had a huge diet coke.
That just shows that, you know, 1,400 years and they're still jahil.
They're still jahil, absolutely. Thank you for that.
This is the point, you know. And, you know, just look at the ugly stuff they're building there. I mean, it's horrendous what they're doing.
It's horrible what they've done to the place.
You're going to get me started on this now, but...
Yeah,
you know,
I'd like to get you started, Dr.
You know, well, this is
just
not
give,
a revival.
Give it the full treatment.
What Imam Khomeini did was a revival.
Yes.
Not what they're doing.
This not what they're doing. Absolutely.
This is like, you know, just a... how should I say it? These are like a bunch of ignorant people who just recently... You know, as we say, recently became literate or recently, you know, discovered indoor plumbing. And look at what they're doing to Mecca and Medina, you know.
Exactly.
You know, it's a catastrophe.
You
know, it's a catastrophe.
It's
know?
A catastrophe
destroying
on a grand
all the
scale.
History of Islam.
Yeah.
And this is something, I mean, you know, I really wonder at some of these Muslims, and I'm talking Shia and Sunni.
Yeah.
Like, do you care that they're destroying all the history of Islam? Do you even care about that?
Yeah. I mean,
you care about the
crew,
fact that they're
they?
Destroying, they're destroying the Prophet's house, Hazrat Khadija's house. They're destroying all the historic mosques.
Sure.
You care about that? You don't really care, do you? Because if you did, you would do something about it.
You would do something about it, exactly.
But well, we don't. We don't care. And it's actually coming up recently. It's going to come up in a few days. I think it's the 8th or 9th of Shawwal where they destroyed Baqi, when they took over Baqi after the Ottomans.
Sure.
Okay, so you have Jannat al-Baqi, which is, you know, the historic, you know, graveyard in Islamic history, where you have, you know, Imam Hassan alayhi salam, you have Imam Sajjad alayhi salam.
Yes, you have several.
Babar alayhi salam, you have Imam Sadr alayhi salam.
That's
you have
right. Four great imams are buried.
You have, besides these, you know, illustrious and luminous, you know, personalities, you have tens and hundreds of others from the beginning of Islam that are buried
there.
Look at it today. You go there and it's like dust, and you know they got it. You know, whatever. And so these are the people that are supposed to be the guardians of Islam and the guardians of the holy sites.
No, they're not guardians of anything.
They're building Big Ben. You know?
Yeah, they're building Big Ben, you're right.
They're building this monster version of Big Ben on top of the Kaaba.
Yeah,
you know? That's you know, that's who they are. I mean, all I'm trying to say to you is, you know, do you really want a sixfold Big Ben shadow over the Kaaba? Is that really what? Because that's what's happening right now. You're doing tawaf and there's a shadow of Big Ben over. I mean, isn't that symbolic of who their master is, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, Mecca's in London now, so I might as well go there. I might find a Kaaba somewhere around there, next to the Parliament buildings.
They move the Kaaba to, you know,
they move the Kaaba to the Westminster.
You know, might as well.
Yeah. Oh my God, that says
so,
everything.
So you know what we're talking about is a real revival. We're not talking about the show that they're putting on.
Sure,
you know?
Absolutely.
And so. That's the thing, is you had this real pure Islam, which was almost forgotten, which they really tried hard to suppress for centuries.
Yes, that's a very good point.
Whether it was
in Iraq,
or whether it was in Iran, or whether it was in Lebanon, where they were trying to, you know, label the people who follow that school as, you know, kafir or as whatever.
Exactly.
And then a personality like Imam you know, Allah brings him, and, you know, how can you deny him? I mean,
this is the problem they had. This was the exact problem they couldn't deny him. They couldn't deny him.
I'm talking about, you know, your average, you know, Sunni Muslim around the world, you know, loved him.
He was completely taken aback.
Right. I mean, you know, anybody who has a genuine love for Allah and for the Prophet, peace be upon him, in the heart, which is what, you know, 96-97% of the Muslims have.
Sure.
Sunni and Shia. So, sure. Don't get me wrong. I'm trying to say that.
No.
You know, it's that tiny, small fraction of Nasibi Takfiri, you know, agents of the West who have a problem with people like Imam. Why would any Muslim in the world have a problem with Imam?
No, I don't think they did have a problem.
They didn't.
Yeah, they didn't. They had the posters of Imam Khomeini out everywhere.
Right. So nobody had a problem.
Nobody had a problem.
You know, from Indonesia to Senegal, from, you know, Bosnia to, you know,
right across the Arab world.
Right. I mean, to, you know, to Central Africa. I mean, everybody was like, hey, this guy's cool. We want, you know, this is what we were waiting for, you know.
Yeah, the pictures are still up in New Delhi and India as well as
right.
Nigeria.
This is what we were waiting for a real leader in Islam who, you know, is proud to be Muslim, who is not, who understands that Islam is going to give you the solutions in your life.
Yeah.
And who is not trying to, you know, modify Islam to make it a little bit more, you know, socialist or a little bit more liberal or a little bit more westernized bit more easternized, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Who's like, this is it. It's Islam as it was revealed in the Quran, as the Sunnah of the Prophet as it was.
Sure.
And as, you know, Imam Ali alayhi salam after the Prophet continued to guide.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, the thing is, this was the real McCoy, as we would say in Scotland.
Right, and so, exactly, the real McCoy. And so the point is that, of course, this is going to lead to a spiritual revival around the world, because this is what humanity
was looking for. Exactly.
And remember, you know, our creation is not separate from Islam. You know, Islam was revealed for our souls.
Yes.
For our being.
For our being, for our very existence.
Right. It's like the software for, you know, our soul.
Exactly.
It's like the instruction manual or the program or the algorithm for our soul. I mean, you're the engineer,
but I couldn't have put it better myself. I mean, if you take a laptop, it's exactly that. I mean, it's like Windows.
It's like the operating system.
Exactly.
You know, it's not only the operating system, it's the machine code that the operating system is.
Why are we sounding like the Matrix now all of a sudden? But anyway, the thing is that you're absolutely right. I mean, that's the thing.
You know, this is not separate from humanity.
No, it is not.
You know, why are we surprised about this?
Mm.
Why are we looking at this thing only from a historical perspective? It's not history.
That's right. It's not history.
You have humanity, both individuals and humanity as a whole, who are thirsting for this guidance from Allah.
Exactly.
And so you have these religions which are atrophied, like Christianity, like certain branches of Islam, which are not capable of...
No, they're not. You're right. They have atrophied.
Entering that need, are not able to, you know, quench that thirst that the soul has.
Yes.
And here it is. Here it is. Mm. You know, the Islam of Ahlul Bayt with an amazing, you know, person like Imam being able to present it to the world.
Exactly. And it caused a huge reverberation and revival right across even the Western world, because the statistics speak for themselves.
Right, and this is more, and, you know, I'm also saying this to fellow Shias, you know, this is more than just, advertising the religion. This is more than just explaining this is way beyond your traditional, you know, things that a scholar does, or like writing a book or holding a speech. This is about living it.
Living it. Ah, now there's the key.
Okay.
Because
this is the point. Mm. And this is something that, and I'm addressing this more to the Shias, which is we have a problem in our religious culture, which is we think that all we have to do is, you know, do tabligh.
Yes.
All we have to do is explain the laws.
No, you have
to live it.
You have to live this religion, exactly. Absolutely.
It's not about just, you know, I'm going to tell you what religion is, or this is what the ayah says, or this is what the hadith says.
Sure.
It's about, okay, now implement it in your life.
Exactly.
Okay, and it's interesting, if you look at Imam's books, especially if you look at, you know, Islamic government, Mulazzabi.
That's right. That's right.
If you look at all his other books, his point, one of the main points, one of the main themes of Imam Khomeini is that Islam is about action. It's not about just talking about it.
Exactly.
Or having a class about it, or getting an A on your FIQh exam of, you know, I knew all the ahkam. Okay? It's about implementing it.
Implementing it, yes. Living it.
Right. Islam is not, as he used to say, tatil. It's not, it's not closed. You know, the shop is not closed.
No.
It's open.
It's open.
You know?
It's open till the day of judgment.
Right. Just because we're in Ghaibat Kubra, just because we're in the occultation, in the greater occultation, doesn't mean that we close down the religion because the imam is an occultation. That's, in fact, the whole point is you got to get the religion going again so the imam comes. It's not that you're just going to sit there and wait, okay. You know, this is the thing that he used to say, which is, you know, nobody denies that even in the greater occultation, things like prayer, fasting, you know, all those things that we consider to be the normal wajib things, that they exist, right? Nobody denies that, right?
Sure.
Nobody says these things are you know, closed down now because the imam is not present, correct?
Absolutely.
So he said, well, that doesn't... So the same thing goes for having a government. The same thing goes for having a strong ummah.
Yes.
The same thing goes for...
I couldn't agree more.
You know, why do we see those things are shut down because of the ghaibat, and these things aren't? Well, that's more important than this.
Yes, he was saying that. I mean, he said the establishment of an Islamic government is more important than prayer.
Right. So that doesn't mean you don't pray. Of course you pray.
Of course you pray. But your prayer has to have some value. It has to have some meaning.
Right. And so these are all the things. This is the beauty of what Imam was saying.
Yes.
He was a person who really understood Islam.
Yes, he really understood Islam. I think that's you've hit the nail on the head.
You know, we have this famous saying by Shahid Sadr, Shahid Muhammad Babar Sadr, you know, and may God bless his soul. And, you know, he used to talk about, he said, you know, and I'm trying to say it in English.
Yes.
He was talking about Imam and telling his students and telling the people at that time in Najaf and in Iraq, because Imam was there at that time, before the revolution. He was saying about, he said, you know, melt, and become one with Imam. Zob.
That's right, Zob. Yes, yes, very good.
You know, like, you know, like an
you
iron.
You dissolve yourself into like salt does into water.
He said, dissolve yourself into Imam the way Imam dissolved himself into Islam.
Into Islam, mashallah, very nice.
This is the point. Hmm. Here's a man who was completely immersed, dissolved in Islam.
Yes, yes.
And understood it. And was a very capable, you know, advocate of it, and a very capable teacher of Islam.
Sure, sure. The main thing is that, you know, in the last few minutes, if you can sort of just put us in the picture now as to how great the revival has actually been, you know, how great has been the impact on the world at large in terms of what Imam has done.
That's a good question. Now, let's just look at some examples. We can also just, you know, just what we've experienced in our own lifetime.
Absolutely.
If you look at a country like Iran, which is a major country in the world,
in
terms of historically, you know,
strategically,
civilization,
wise,
its location geographically, and you know its impact culturally, especially in the Muslim world, in this part of the world. Well, obviously, you had this big society and this large country. It is one of the largest, you know, countries of the region.
Oh, it is. Definitely.
And one of the largest populations. Well, it completely reversed itself from, you know, going down that westernization and that secularization, which was, you know, being forced onto it during the time of the previous regime.
Mm.
And now it has become this, you know, intense religious, you know, based society. It doesn't mean everybody is religious. It means that the framework of the society
is based on religion.
The strategic goals, the laws, and the larger framework in which the society is moving is within the framework of the Quran and in the framework of Islam.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
And this has so many consequences for the rest of the world.
It does. Of course it does. It sends out a huge message.
This important nation and this important society moving in this direction. Mm. And the beautiful thing is that it has shown in these last 34 years that you can achieve material and worldly success.
Yes. I mean,
with
that,
going in the religious route,
sure,
and going the Islamic route. So
sure,
it's not about...
And you even become,
used to say,
yeah, you even become more democratic as well, don't you?
Well, everything from democracy to technology,
yeah,
to, you know, development to infrastructure to education, you know. All
yeah, there's
the
nothing left
that,
out.
All the things that they were telling us 30, 40 years ago,
yes,
that you have
precisely
to
my point,
give up religion and especially give up Islam in order to achieve that. That kind of Turkish model, that kind of, you know, Atatürk.
Yeah.
You know, you have to become European in order to advance.
Yes.
Or the thing which then, you know, Reza Khan in Iran was trying to establish in the you know, 30s,
days of the 40s. Shah. Yeah, that's right. Yes.
Of course, all of that has been turned on its head.
Exactly.
That
exactly.
Never has in the history of this nation, this country, been so advanced and so, you know, at the forefront of so many things.
Yes, only in the last 34 years.
And it all came after the establishment of an Islamic government.
Absolutely
so
right.
So this is a major thing. Then you look at all the other movements that are occurring in places like Lebanon, in Iraq.
Yes,
and all these
yes.
other places.
Yeah.
Where people and, you know, Muslims have awakened and have decided that they're not going to stand up to occupation and to oppression.
Sure.
And if you look at the miracles that have happened in Lebanon, you know, this so-called, you know, army that couldn't be defeated was defeated.
That's right. We're talking about
you know, the first,
Satan Yahu
the first,
and his Zionists, yes.
The first Arab army, or the first Arab, you know, I don't even call it army, it's a militia.
It's
you know,
it's just a militia,
to...
and it knocked the fourth strongest army off the map.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's funny how you say it. It's just a militia, you know, but, you know, it's like... So the point is that
right.
we have these things that are happening in the Islamic world,
sure,
that, you know, are a result of what Imam was teaching us in terms of following the real Islam.
Exactly, and exactly. And how much
and
of a difference
things,
that's
so
made.
This was in the Islamic world. You have a lot of the movements that you see in the Sunni world.
Yes.
Taking inspiration from what happened.
Very
Iran,
good. Yes. Excellent point.
And from
yes.
Imam himself.
Yes.
And, you know, across the board, across the Islamic world, you have this general, look, really, this is something that we have to be very clear about.
Mm-hmm.
When Imam came to the scene, the main thesis, the thing that was dominant, the thought that was dominant and that was being, you know, pushed onto everyone was that you have to give up religion and you have to give up Islam
that's
in order
right,
to be
that's right.
a civilized human being.
That's a very good point, yes.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And this was something that was, you know, among the Arab elites, it was all Arab nationalism or it was all socialism and Marxism.
Sure.
You know, if you look at all the elites around the world, it was either you were part of the, you know, American camp or you were part of the Soviet camp.
Yeah, the Soviet camp, yeah.
You were either a liberal or a nationalist
or a Marxist.
Yeah. And you know, here Imam came and said, no, Islam is the real path,
the real way.
Salvation.
Yes. That's right.
In this world and in the next.
And in the next.
And notice, because people will be like, well, look at what's happening now with these. Well, all these Islamic movements that don't follow the school of Ahlul Bayt or don't follow that kind of, you know, moderate way of looking at things, that way that is based on wisdom that Imam taught us, all of them are failing now.
They are, of course,
and,
they
you know,
are.
And it's interesting, and I think it's very good to look at an example of what is happening, for example, in Egypt.
In Egypt,
the minute,
yes, I was going to say that.
The minute you had the Ikhwan, you know, becoming friendly with the Takfiris, becoming friendly with the Americans, becoming friendly with that American Islam and that kind of, you know, with the enemies of Islam and not following Imam's path, which is that you stand up to the enemies of Islam.
Sure.
But that you also are not, you know, that you emphasize unity within Muslims.
Sure.
And that you don't try to turn this into a Sunni Shia thing.
Yes.
The minute the Ikhwan started going away from Imam's teaching in these regards, they were completely, you know, defeated.
Exactly.
So, this is the thing.
Yeah.
Imam is not just simply a historic thing that happened 34 years ago or 20 years ago. It's not just, you know, something that was for the history books. It was about reviving the fitra and allowing that fitra, which is part of all of humanity, to find its real, you know, goal.
Sure.
And be able to find its perfection. Sure. And that's why to this day, the more time passes, the more he's relevant.
Exactly.
Okay? The more we realize what a great, incredible human being he was.
I think Dr. Matti Trabi, on that note, because we've run out of time and it's been great, thanks very much for that valuable contribution you've made today on this subject of how Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, revived religion not only in the Islamic world but for the world at large as well. But thanks a lot for your contribution today. I really appreciate
it. My pleasure.
Thank you. And it just thank you very much. And it just leaves me to say, for the rest of our audience, thank you very much for listening today. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening today and goodbye.
Hello and welcome back to The Light, a man-made winter fairyland that's what visitors may refer to an ice and snow festival in the Chinese city of Harbin. Three giant ox sculptors are on display in this year's edition of the event as China is celebrating the Year of Ox. The park features hundreds of ice sculptors and castles. The Chili Festival traditionally draws millions of people from around the globe, but it's now receiving a limited number of visitors due to the COVID-19 pandemic.
Australia is offering an environmentally friendly kayak tour in Sydney's harbor to both entertain participants and help clean up the ocean. The tours offer paddles, buckets, sieves, and picker sticks for removing trash from the harbor. Each month, about 20 such tours take place. They collect around 200 kilograms of garbage. Organizers believe big changes can be made with these tiny steps.
I do feel like we make a difference. I don't feel like it's just about the rubbish that we pick up, but I feel like it's about sharing a message of what we're doing and I guess teaching people about recycling, using less plastic. I think a lot of people walk around the boardwalk and think that Sydney Harbour is beautiful and pristine, and it is a very clean waterway compared to others in the world, but once you're down here in a kayak or if you go for a swim, you really notice just how much rubbish is down there, so I think it opens people's eyes up.
Plastic pollution has a direct and deadly effect on wildlife. According to the United Nations Environment Programme, 8 million tons of plastic goes into the ocean globally every year. Experts say that by 2050, there will be more plastic than fish in the ocean.
An annual light festival lights up the Danish capital, Copenhagen, bringing color and life to the city amid the coronavirus pandemic. Architectural lighting, designs, and pieces have adorned the city in the winter season, attracting many visitors. Some 30 light installations are located in and around the city, spreading on the bridges, buildings, and squares. The organizers have planned two routes, each 3 kilometers long, so visitors can enjoy the festival while practicing social distancing.
A light festival in these dark times is very nice. It's some brightness in your life. You get stimulated through the art. And
this is the fourth year the Copenhagen Light Festival is taking place. However, this year, due to the COVID-19 pandemic, guided tours, talks, and pop-up events have been cancelled. Instead, the organizers have prepared an interactive map so visitors can find routes and information about the installations.
Humans are not the only ones having fun with snowfall. Two giant baby pandas at a Belgian zoo are also taking the advantage.